Hi, I'm Erin Lundy.
And I'm Madeline Walden, and this is
Aquarium of the Podcific,
a podcast brought to you by Aquarium of the Pacific, Southern California's largest aquarium.
Join us as we learn alongside the experts in animal care, conservation, and more.
Welcome back to Aquarium of the Podcific. I'm Madeline Walden, the aquarium's digital content and community manager.
And I'm Erin Lundy, conservation coordinator for mammals and birds and animal care specialist, especially with frogs.
Especially specialist. Which is the theme of our podcast today. Today we're going to talk about the mountain yellow-legged frog. And I am so honored to have an incredible guest today. Her name is Erin Lundy, and she's also my podcast host, and she's sitting right next to me.
So unfortunately, I will not be asking any questions. I hope.
You might be asking yourself.
I hope you know the answers to my questions.
Some existential questions. What is a frog?
A frog is an amphibian.
Mm-hmm. I'm saying you have to ask yourself every day.
I'm sorry. What is a frog? A frog is an amphibian. I also told Madeline to stop me if I ever get on a frog tangent that goes too deep. If I go into the frog hole, she will pull me back out.
No, I think you're great about communicating. You know, I'm not a science person. I don't have a background in science. I just have a background in Aquarium of the Pacific.
This is awkward.
I
didn't know.
So whenever you're just so great about communicating in a way that's digestible, but also shows your passion for, especially this project that you work so hard on. So I'm just really excited to hear it in depth and to learn along with our audience.
To learn about our mountain yellow-legged frogs.
Mountain yellow-legged frogs.
Rana muscosa. Mm-hmm.
But this is also our last episode of the season. This is our 10th episode podcast. It's not over. Don't worry. We'll be back.
No, it's been a really great season, and we've had actually a lot of different guests on, and I think that we've learned about both the animal care side of things from a lot of different keepers. Mm-hmm. If I had to choose what my favorite fact I learned this season was, what would yours be? We've learned a lot.
We've learned so much. I don't know. I think just my favorite fact, and this isn't necessarily a fact, it's been watching you learn things. Because I'm learning too, but you're so visual. You're like literally like eyes open, like need to take a breath, like need to exit the room for a moment.
Okay?
You're like, they do what? Seastars start off as two diamonds. What are you talking about?
Why is there a 600-pound octopus? I still don't know the answer. And I have talked to a couple of our guests and, you know, people around the aquarium who've given me feedback. And they are routinely surprised at how much we don't know. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a really salient point that, like, people know a lot about the projects that they're particularly involved in. But it is difficult to know in-depth information about every species that we house because we have so many.
We have so many. I mean, we have 12,000 animals here, and we have specialists in every single field and every single, you know, kind of group of that. But something that is part of their day-to-day is mind-blowing for someone else to hear.
Specifically me.
Specifically you, Erin. Exactly. So I think that's what's been so cool about the podcast is kind of just tricking our colleagues into talking about all the amazing stuff that they're doing.
It's been a trick,
though. It's been a trick.
They didn't know they were being recorded.
No, they
didn't. I think that's like a violation. I don't think we can do that. We probably need to describe all the episodes that we've had so far. No, I think my favorite fact, aside from the 600-pound octopus, that I don't know if it's my favorite or just the most terrifying.
The scariest fact.
I love that sea turtles' fat is green from all the green things that they eat. And I really wonder what color my fat is based off of.
That's what we're going to find out today.
Today's episode is about dissecting Erin and determining what she eats the most of. That, and then also that the octopus have 9 brains. Mm-hmm. That's a lot.
Donut shaped.
It's a lot of brains. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot. I really liked getting sort of an inside look. Also, Josh just like totally roasting us on our own podcast.
Yeah, that was great.
It's one of my favorite things. If you guys haven't listened to the jelly episode, Josh is just like, he has the driest humor, but he is such a good human too. Mm-hmm. And he's so smart about all the jellies that even listening to that episode back was amazing for me. And I felt like I was learning again because it's so complicated that I couldn't absorb it all.
Yeah, that's
time.
Part of it too, is going back and editing everything. I learned so much all over again, or it's something I missed. I'm like, I wish I would have asked about that more. Like, that's fascinating. So we're definitely going to have new people on next season, but let us know what your favorite episodes are. Let us know who your favorite speakers were. And we'd love to invite them back on to talk about,
one
and done. That's it. That's all you get. No, but I feel like, you know, we're so lucky too that our specialists that we've had on are specialists in other things even. So I am looking forward to the future of this podcast alongside you.
And science education from people who are doing the work is like, the exact niche that I am so interested
in. It's so valuable.
It's been a good time. This has been one of the most fun experiences of things that I've done here because I get to learn so much about everything that's happening. And today I get to teach.
Today you get to teach. So I'm going to let Erin kind of run with this episode and just kind of interject in between. I didn't ask Instagram questions. Shoot.
We have no Instagram, questions.
So I will play the role as Instagram today, which is what I typically do. Cool. Well, I'm so excited to get into this project and to hear more about it. I guess I'm just going to pretend like I know nothing, which is pretty close to the truth. Only about this specific mountain yellow-legged frog project.
And you actually know a lot about it because we're friends and I know. I tell you about it.
We're friends? You're admitting that?
Scratch that
from the record. Cool. Well, let's get into the episode. Ba-da-ba-ba-da-da. Da-da-da.
Boom.
Hi, Erin. Thank you so much for being our guest on Aquarium of the Podcific today.
Hi, Erin. It's so nice to be me on the Aquarium of the Podcific. It's very jarring because I'm so used to interviewing someone.
Yeah, and having someone to, like,
to pester.
Of, yeah, exactly.
And now I can't, I'm being pestered.
You're pestering
in
yourself.
A good way. Mm-hmm. I guess I have just gotten used to learning and not... Mm-hmm. Telling.
Not telling anyone.
But I want to talk to you guys a little bit about a project that has really been sort of the defining project of my career. I, for a little background on me, started here at the aquarium 5.5 years ago. Wow. Mm-hmm. 5.5 years ago. And I was hired on because of my experience with marine mammals and penguins. And obviously, frogs are neither of those things.
It's an interesting journey from marine mammals and penguins to frogs. Very, not necessarily polar opposites, but pretty close.
I just like things that sometimes are in water and are sometimes on land.
That's true. Penguins can be very amphibian-like in that way. Yeah, same with marine mammals.
So it works out.
They just can't breathe down there.
Maybe they could try harder, though. Because frogs can. And honestly, that's really what sold me on them, is their ability to absorb oxygen through their skin. But, yeah, I got hired on to take care of totally different species, and... Similar, I think it was Brooke that was saying that no one really has a linear career path when it comes to working with animals. Mm-hmm. And I think that 5 years ago, if you told me that I would be heavily involved with frogs, I would be very confused as to how I got there. But I started helping to cover some of our amphibian gallery and helping to just, like, provide coverage on the weekends. And as I kind of grew more and more in that role... And we also kind of concurrently were developing a partnership with USGS and some other institutions that were...
What's USGS?
U.S. Geological Survey. Thank you. So that is a federal agency, and they are actually who holds the permit for our Mountain Yellow-Legged Frog Project. Thank you. So as we sort of developed these relationships and started to think about our prospective involvement in this project, I sort of became one of the people who had the relevant experience. And it was actually me and one of my coworkers who no longer works here, unfortunately, but it now works for the World Wildlife Care Network, which is really cool. And so she gets pictures of the frogs almost daily. Sorry, Frankie.
Shout out to Frankie,
who was sort of my partner in the project's inception. But she and I worked really hard to make that project what it is. And now I'm hopeful that we can teach more people what a mountain yellow-legged frog is and why they should care about them, and also actually help to save a species, which is pretty cool.
Did you have any background with frogs at all or even an interest in frogs before this?
Don't tell the frogs.
Don't. I'm going to tell all of them.
I had no experience with amphibians, like, professionally or personally. I grew up in Hawaii, and there's not... any native, it depends who you ask, considered not to be any native species of amphibians in Hawaii. I mean, it's an island, right? And so there are invasives. There's, like, cane toads. There's koki frogs. And there are some poison dart frogs that were introduced that some people consider endemic, but that's its own thing. But I didn't grow up around a lot of amphibians. Like, they just didn't really exist. And I certainly liked the idea of them, but didn't know anything about them. And so starting here was sort of the first introduction I had to them. And I was so nervous starting to work with them. Because, like, a sea lion, if, like, I don't know, something happens, like its water gets a little colder, it's fine. It's a mammal. It's creating its own heat. It's okay.
We kind of talked about that in our last episode with Reed. You know, there's, you know, our marine mammals can withstand a 2-degree, depending on the weather outside, versus, you know, a endangered species, like a mountain yellow legged frog, who we have a permit to care for here, you know, that really can't fluctuate.
Yeah, and it was the most nerve-wracking transition to take care of these, like, big things that are fine to little things that maybe aren't fine if you do something slightly wrong. And so there was a big learning curve for me because taking care of amphibians is so significantly different than marine mammals or seabirds or really anything that kind of regulates itself. And something I've come to learn to love about the amphibians is that they exist so in harmony with their environment that it's not really about caring for the individual animal, but ensuring that their habitat is clean and appropriate and that they have everything that they need. And if their environment is generally healthy, the animals are generally healthy. And I think that's a really, that was the biggest thing I had to like learn for myself is like, hey, you can kind of fix almost anything for a frog if you keep everything clean and nice and healthy. And I don't know. I just, that's not the case for seals and sea lions, you know? So that's been really fun.
Well, it's not the case in the wild right now, unfortunately. And that's kind of, we'll get into why we are caring for these animals.
So sad.
But I know, it's such a bummer.
But yeah, they really live in harmony with their environment. And there is disharmony. What's that word? There isn't harmony right now because of some anthropogenic causes. But
what's anthropogenic? What's
that mean? Human-caused. Anthropogenic means human-caused. And so a lot of people think that we live in the Anthropocene, which is just essentially we've done so much to alter the way that the world works that we are in a new era that is purely based off of all of the things that humans have done. And that's sort of disheartening to think about, that we have done so much that it's sort of overcome the natural processes of the world. But at the same time, I think it also goes to show that humans have so much ability to change that there is hope, you know, like we did a lot of stuff, but we didn't know better at the time. And so now working to kind of rectify all those things and fix it, it's cool to see that we can have such a significant impact when we are trying.
Can you name another example of something that we have done that with, where there has been, you know, human caused issues and we've been able to reverse it? I'm not the expert on this at all, but I can think about the ozone and how...
Yeah, that's actually a huge one.
Yeah, the ozone is huge.
Turns out you are an expert on this.
But I know that, you know, holes in the ozone were a huge issue, or the breakdown of our ozone was a huge issue. And they were able to ban the substances or the chemicals that cause...
CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons.
Period.
Period.
And the ozone has been repairing itself. And I'm not the expert on this, so...
Kind of the expert on this.
I'm the expert on nothing. That's my job here, is to be the audience surrogate and to ask you questions.
Like, I think it's a super pertinent example of like how we can work to fix things that we've done. And to be honest, like, we've done a lot of damage that we've already reversed. It's just that it's not recent, and so we're not thinking about it. But like, I'm in my master's program right now. One of the things that I am so shocked routinely to learn about is how bad air quality was in, especially California, in like the 50s, where you literally, there was like no days per year that it was healthy to go outside. And that's partially because of the geography of Southern California. And like, there's this air basin that traps all the pollutants, but we also weren't regulating pollutants in any significant way. That I think it was like last year's data or 2 years ago's data that there was only like one day where it was very unhealthy to go outside versus like every other day.
That's why all those old 1950s movies have that like yellow tint on it. It's the smog.
It's just the air.
It's not the film. It's the air.
It's just how bad
that's
the air
how everything
was.
Looked then.
Yeah. And so, I mean, there's things like that, right, where we didn't even think about the effects that that was having on us. But like, if you talk to someone from who grew up in, you know, that time, they'd be like, yeah, the air was so bad, I could not go outside some days. And I would like cough all the time. And I was like, that sounds terrible. Like, I never worried about that. And so,
we're so lucky.
We are working to fix things. And I think that now that we have more information, we're sort of obligated to undo a lot of the things that we've definitely done. And we are doing it. And so that makes me feel hopeful. Especially when you think about the fact that over 40% of amphibian species are either considered endangered or threatened, which means that their habitat and their populations are declining in some significant way. I am really sad for all the frogs I'll never know.
How many frogs are there?
There's a lot of frogs.
There's a lot of frogs.
Yeah, no. Get it out. Oh, there it is. I had a frog in my throat. Had to say it. Do it to him.
Had to do it to him.
But yeah. And so there's a lot of different species of frogs, and I learn about frogs that existed that I will never meet because they're gone now. And one that's really cool.
That's so sad.
I know. It is a real bummer. I
can't think too much about it.
I mean, like any species that's totally extinct now, you're like, I wish I knew what that was. But there was a gastric brooding frog. There was actually several gastric brooding frogs, but one very recently went extinct, like within the last 20 years, that would just raise its baby in its tummy, and it would just have a bunch of babies that would just crawl out of its mouth when they are ready. And that's cool.
Scott's like, face.
Scott is horrified. Scott, you don't have to worry about it because it'll never happen again. I know.
Sad.
The gastric brooding frogs are gone.
Terrifying.
And so, sad. To prevent me from having that experience over and over again, we should really be working to preserve these species. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, sometimes I think about all the amphibians that I will never get to meet, and that sounds really dorky, but there's so many amphibians that have cool adaptations and can produce these, like, substances that might have antibacterial properties, mm-hmm. and there's, you know, these animals that play this huge role in their ecosystem because most amphibians exist as, like, a larval stage in the water mm-hmm. where they're eating detritus and, like, stuff off the
What's
bottom.
What's detritus?
Just, like, gunk. Okay, cool. Like, scientific mm-hmm. word exactly. for gunk. Mm-hmm. And they'll eat algae, and so they become these, like, primary consumers of, like, whatever is growing. Mm-hmm. And then they go through metamorphosis where their whole body changes and they become these, like, terrestrial animals that mostly eat insects or sometimes lizards. And so they connect the food web in such an different way than most mm-hmm. animals do because they totally transform what they're eating and what they're doing over the course of their lifetime, that when you lose amphibians from those environments, you lose a lot of that interconnectivity, and it's just kind of weakens the strength of, you know, that ecosystem. So I'll just never know some of these frogs. But mountain yellow-legged frogs are the ones that we are specifically working to save here at the aquarium, and that's a project that started before we got involved with it. We are now a partner in that project. But they have taken over my life, as Madeline knows. And they are one of the coolest frogs I've ever met. But there's nothing that special about them. Before anyone asks, nothing specifically that special about them. Because I get that question all
the
time.
They have yellow legs.
They do. But there's also a foothill yellow-legged frog and a Sierra yellow-legged frog. And so there's a lot of yellow-legged frogs. Mm-hmm. But and they're all pretty close related. But when people ask me why we're saving this specific species, you know, with sea otters and with sunflower stars, it's really easy. Like, that's a keystone species. Mm-hmm. That is protecting the entire environment. And sometimes you look at one frog and you're like, if they were gone, like, how would the ecosystem mm-hmm. be impacted? And part of the reason, and the major reason, is, like, we did this, so mm-hmm. we should be fixing it. Mm-hmm. And the other part is that, like, redundancy in any sort of ecological system is important for the health of that system. And so you want there to be multiple species of frogs. You want there to be, like, adaptability mm-hmm. to climate change and loss in different ways so that ecosystems can evolve as the world changes. And so if we lose a lot of those, like, variables and we lose a lot of those species, we're not going to see ecosystems bounce back the way that they should when there are climate-related impacts mm-hmm. or other things that happen to those habitats.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about, you know, so we know that this species isn't necessarily integral to its ecosystem, but what role do amphibians play in their ecosystems?
Yeah, so they, like I said earlier, are usually just kind of a part of this trophic web that connects a lot of different animals together. And so they're part of the food chain is not really a good analogy. A food web is mm-hmm. a better analogy. Mm-hmm. And they allow there to be food and prey, but also predators for a lot of different species because of how diverse their diet is over the course of their life. And also, amphibians, some people say they can be sort of ecological indicators of the health mm-hmm. of an ecosystem. I don't always agree with that, because it turns out frogs are much hardier than you think they are. Mm-hmm. I should have known that 5 years ago when I started working with them, and I panicked every time I had to do anything. But if you think about how they've evolved over millions of years, they live now in desert ecosystems. They live now in, like, totally aquatic ecosystems. Mm-hmm. There's totally aquatic frogs. There's amphibians everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really cool that they are hardy enough and they can evolve so rapidly to adapt to change that's happening around them. But in the same vein, if you have a lot of chemicals in the water, you're going to kill all the frogs. Mm-hmm. So in that way, mm-hmm. it can be a really good indicator of the health of their overall environment.
Very cool. What's the difference between an amphibian and a reptile?
That's a good question. So they are both considered herptiles or herps, but amphibians are... they have permeable skin. They don't typically have scales, although there's a couple exceptions to that. Mm-hmm. I think a couple of species of Sicilians have scales.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they are mostly fossorial and terrifying. Don't look them up.
We have some Sicilians here.
We do. We mm-hmm. have aquatic Sicilians, which have no scales.
And adorable. They look like sock puppets.
They're really cute.
They're really cute.
Do not Google what the inside of their mouth looks like. And if you need to, you can, but it's really scary.
So if you're driving listening to this, or you're if you're stationary somewhere, not driving.
Why would you say
say that. If I don't want driving. Someone who's driving. I don't want someone who's driving to look it up. Oh, okay. But you're put a note in your brain to look that up later because I guess it's terrifying. I can't wait to see. Specifically, do not look it up if you're driving. Put a note in your brain. Pause this episode now.
I think it's Typhlonectes natans, but look up aquatic Sicilian mouse.
Ooh, do I get to quiz you on species names? Sure, now, since if you want to. What's mountain yellow-legged frog's species name?
Rana muscosa. If I didn't know that, it would all be over for me, though.
Cut the mic.
Cut the mic. She's canceled.
She's done. Scott, what happened?
Oh, the mouth.
You found it? Let's see it.
Is that this?
Yeah.
Ah. Whoa.
That's what it looks like in there. Is it a little spooky in there?
That's that more than a little spooky.
Aquatic Sicilians are really cool.
Nature is so beautiful.
Nature is wonderful. Apparently, the fossorial Sicilians that have scales are even scarier, and I am scared to even Google them, so I wouldn't even do it. But they look like a big worm. Mm. But what other quizzes
you have? I don't know how many frogs. You're like magnificent tree frog. I know that one.
Yeah, those are. Latoria splendida? Is it Latoria?
What about Sonoran desert toad? I'm thinking of the animals we have here.
Incilius alvarius.
Exactly what I was going to say.
That is exactly what I was going to say.
What about the...
He used to be bufo, but they've changed how they classify toads.
No more bufo?
He's not a bufo
Alfred's
anymore.
Not a bufo anymore?
No, Alfred's no bufo.
He's no bufo. What other frogs do I know?
Scott, what frogs do you know?
Oh, spring peepers. We get a lot of those in Pennsylvania.
Spring peepers. Spring I don't know
peepers.
What they're...
That sounds normal.
I
want to
look up what their thing is.
Frogs.
I mean,
so
I've seen
loud.
Them. I don't think I know what they're... Chorus frogs. Oh, they're pseudacris.
Yeah, chorus frogs, that's right.
But we have pseudacris. Which one do we have? We have Pacific tree frogs, which are pseudacris. Anyway, that's kind of cool.
Do all frogs metamorphize?
No. Some are direct developers, which is sort of interesting in and of itself. So the Kihansi spray toad, which I recognize is it a frog? The common names always mess everything up. But they are direct developers, and so when they give birth, they just give birth to a tiny little version of themselves, and it is very cute. If you ever want to see the cutest little thing in the entire world, look up Kihansi spray toads, which are native to Tanzania, and then also look up how small their babies are, because look at the little babies.
The little babies
riding on his back.
Adorable.
But those guys actually have, I think, the smallest geographic footprint of any animal on the entire planet because they only live in the spray of the Kihansi waterfall in Tanzania, and then they dammed the waterfall. And turns out all that spray was super important for them to live. And so this population of amphibians went extinct in the wild, but thankfully they had been... Some of them had been collected for a captive assurance colony, which essentially means that there are going to be some genetics that they retain so they can breed them and hopefully reintroduce them. Mm-hmm. And they've been successfully reintroducing these animals for a while. So that's kind of cool.
That is so wild to think that something that can be something so important to them, like the spray of this waterfall.
And we don't even know until
until we remove it. Mm-hmm. And then unfortunately it goes extinct in the wild. That's
That's
so impactful. Like, think about an animal like the axolotl that, from my understanding, is only found in one kind of
one
area
lake
of the world.
In Mexico.
One lake, yeah, exactly. And so here's something even more specific to this one waterfall.
Yeah. They're just a little less cute than axolotls. So I think people care a little less. But when they are, I mean, the direct developers, just them popping out as a tiny toad from the mom is very cute. And I was lucky enough to see a couple of them in person at the Detroit Zoo, where they are part of the conservation work for the Kihansi spray toad. And I was just so enamored by how tiny the little baby toads were and how many of them. Because under the right conditions, they're actually great breeders and they do really well. It's just that they had dammed the waterfall and they didn't realize the impact that was going to have on these animals. So I think it's small changes that we don't necessarily think are going to cause problems.
And I wonder how long it took them to adapt to that waterfall in order to...
It's probably so long.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, we lived here forever.
Yeah, I guess we had... Be guess a part of this thing, and then it's removed. It's like, guess we gotta go.
Guess it's all over for us. So it is interesting. I think part of what they were doing conservation-wise to help preserve the spray toads was they installed mister systems along the waterfall, because I think the dam is a hydroelectric dam. Like, I do think there was a purpose for it. But I know that they're trying to do things to help rectify, and fix what they had removed, and I think that the spray helps. So those are interesting animals in and of themselves. But speaking of small things that we don't realize are going to damage an entire population, we can talk about mountain yellow-legged frogs now.
I have one question for you before we get into that. What's the difference between a toad and a frog?
It's complicated. Usually, toads have thicker skin and are a little bit bumpier and wartier, and usually frogs have more smooth skin. Usually, toads sort of walk They can walk a little bit more than frogs typically do, and frogs will mostly hop. And there's a couple of different things, like toads tend to inhabit slightly drier habitats, and frogs tend to be more aquatic. But I'm using these words because they diverged a while ago, and there's frogs and there's toads, but they can adapt to live in a bunch of different environments. Mm-hmm. And so Panamanian golden frogs are a perfect example. They look like a frog. They were called a frog, but then they realize that they're toads. Mm. And so, although they're called frogs, they're actually toads. And so it's sort of confusing.
So much of that in every single family of animal that we've talked about.
And I think it's sort of like becomes one of those things that there's not a great one way to tell versus the other. Mm-hmm. But usually if you see something sort of like wide and bumpy, is a toad.
Is it like all frogs are toads, all toads are frogs? Mm-mm. No, they're just
separate things. Which is interesting. I think they all fall under anurans, and so the order anura is frogs and toads, and those are two separate things.
Got it. Understand. Cool. All right, let's talk about your faves.
My favorite frogs. Mm-hmm. So mountain yellow-legged frogs are one of those perfect examples of humans changing something in their habitat that we didn't realize was going to cause a huge issue for them. So at one point, and these frogs live in, like, pristine alpine environments. Mm-hmm. They live in fishless waterways. They live in areas where the water is coming from snow melt. So fish never made it all the way up there. Mm-hmm. And they can live at altitudes of, like, 1,000 to 12,000 feet. Super high up.
Yeah.
And so they're also cold weather frogs, which is weird to think about. But regardless. And so there's these mountain frogs. And then people in the 1800s started settling around California. And they were like, hey, you know what would be really cool is if we could do some fishing. And they started introducing trout, specifically, I think, rainbow trout, to the waterways where the mountain yellow-legged frogs lived. Mm-hmm. And it turns out trout eat everything. Mm-hmm. And so between the 1800s and about the 1960s or 70s, when they were still doing these trout introductions, they didn't realize that all of the tadpoles of the mountain yellow-legged frogs were just being sucked up by all these trout that were up there. And fun fact about mountain yellow-legged frogs is they can take up to 4 years to get out of the water and metamorphose. And they spend a really long time as a tadpole, especially if it's a little bit colder that year and they're not getting the nutrients that they need. And so there would be these, like, super plump four-year-old tadpoles just chilling in the water, and then these trout would come around and just eat all of them. So it was a bit
That's devastating to their populations. It takes so long for them to even get to a point that they're coming out of the water, and then they're just being slurped up before they even get there. So I'm assuming that really led to their extinction pretty quickly.
It was a major cause of decline. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at one point, everything I've read says that they used to be the most populous vertebrate in their entire range at the time that they weren't being all eaten by trout. And, you know, if you read, like, old school textbooks, a lot of them are like, you couldn't go 5 feet without seeing a mountain yellow-legged frog. And I was like, that's cool. And to think now, like, that's not the case. Mm-hmm. There are estimated to be less than 200 breeding age adults in the wild. And I went on a field trip specifically to see them at a site where we knew that they existed. Mm-hmm. And we still only saw, like, five. Mm-hmm. And they were all juveniles. And none of them were adults. I've never seen an adult of this species that I work so closely with, which is crazy to think about. But yeah, so trout was a major cause of decline. And, you know, any sort of introduced predator or introduced species is going to have impacts that we don't necessarily think about. Mm-hmm. Like, we're just like, we want to go fishing. Here's some trout. And these animals evolved.
They've
never had predators in their waterway because they evolved in a fishless system that all of a sudden there's these trout that are just coming and eating the little tadpoles. So that was a major cause of decline. And when they realized that, they were like, we should probably do something about this. So they started working to reverse that, and they started doing trout removal in specific sites, and they actually saw the population bounce back. And it was really exciting because they're like, oh, okay, it's the trout. That's the problem.
When would you say this was about?
I think they started doing that in the late 70s or 80s, but don't quote me on that. And they're still doing trout removal to this day for some of these habitats. Like, there are still, like, invasive trout species that are in waterways where they shouldn't be. And so part of making the habitat suitable for mountain yellow-legged frogs again is taking the trout out of the water. And unfortunately, it's never good news for the trout, but
trout doing okay?
The trout are fine. Okay. I mean, like, as a species,
yeah,
they're fine.
As a species overall.
But they weren't supposed to be in those places. And so I think that, you know, that was something that really was one of the first things that we did to help this species.
They started coming back a little bit.
They did. Mm-hmm. And they were doing okay. They were like, okay, cool. Like a few years later, once all the stupid tadpoles got out of the water after they took their sweet time, then they started seeing mountain frogs again. And then it wasn't until the 90s that they started describing this massive loss of amphibians worldwide. Mm-hmm. And everyone was like, what's going on? And apparently it was at some conference that scientists came together and they're like, this is the species that I primarily study and I can't find it anywhere. And other people were having the same experience where they'd come up to each other and they'd be like, I also can't find my species anywhere. Or there's like only two individuals where previously there were thousands.
There's abundance, yeah.
And it turns out that there has been a disease process that has been attacking amphibians worldwide. And it is a fungal disease called chytridiomycosis caused by Batrachochytrium dendrobatidus, which is also known as BD.
I was going to say that.
Yeah. BD or chytrid fungus. And we didn't really know a lot about it until the late 90s and like the early 2000s. We were studying it much more closely. And it turns out that these massive amphibian die-offs around the world were all tied to the same fungus, which is weird.
Yeah.
And so they've done some research to figure out what happened and why. And chytrid is basically implicated in the decline of most amphibian species. I think there are very few that show any sort of, like, resistance to it. And it's sort of a bummer. I mean, like, it's not something we talk about, but it is a huge disease process that is wiping out this incredibly diverse, you know, range of animals.
Mm-hmm. Two questions. Is it affecting any other species besides amphibians that you know of?
As far as I know, it's not anything besides amphibians, but it is frogs, toads, salamanders, newts. Like, it's all amphibians. There's also B-sal, which is Batrachochytrium salamandrivorans, which is a very, sounds like a spell. Salamandrivorans. But that one is a slightly different, similar fungus, like same genus, but causes slightly different issues. But both funguses attack the skin of the amphibians. And so the reason I'm not quite sure if it affects anyone else is because what it does is it attacks the keratinized. It attacks the keratinized portion of the skin. And so this little fungus will settle into their little skin and then it'll start kind of like eating at the keratin essentially of their skin, and their body's immune reaction is to just thicken up their skin. And so you get these animals where if you take like a microscope slide of what's happened, you just see these areas of like extremely abnormal thickening of the epidermis and that doesn't sound that crazy, except that when you think about how frogs and toads regulate their, like, electrolyte balance and, like,
through
hydration,
their skin, right?
It's through their skin. And so it can impact their respiration. It can impact their ability to take in water when they need to. It impacts their ability to sort of be in balance with their environment.
Maybe move, even, if there's
probably
uncomfortable areas of thick skin. Yeah.
I never had an uncomfortable area of thick skin. I don't actually know what that's like. I don't know what that's like. But I mean, I'm making light of a very sad situation because I have to. But, yeah, it causes all of these problems. And, like, their electrolyte imbalance then makes their organs fail and also makes their muscles not work. And so very characteristic signs of chytrid fungus in frogs would be, you know, frogs always sit, like, all kind of, like, scooched up with their legs poised, ready to bounce at any moment. They'll sit with their legs all the way kind of relaxed back, and it looks weird.
Yeah.
And so if you see frogs doing that, it's unfortunately probably not a good sign. But it also causes mortality pretty rapidly in populations. And so they had seen this bounce back of mountain frogs after they started removing trout. And they're like, we did it. And then I think it was in the 90s and early 2000s, they started going to these historic mountain yellow-legged frog sites. And they would just find waterways full of dead frogs. And, I mean, frogs decay
fast,
which means that those had just died also. And, yeah, I can't even imagine being someone who's like, I'm going out to study my species of interest. And they're all dead. And walking up there and knowing how much work you did to restore a species and then seeing that must be so devastating.
Yeah.
So not to be too much of a bummer, it's still out there and it's still pretty bad. And
do we know what causes chytrid fungus? Is that
It's caused by the fungus, but we think that it was spread worldwide. It's complicated and there's a lot of different theories. Some genetic tests think that it may be originated in Asia, but there is, you can, like, trace it back to Europe and Africa also. So there's a lot of different places around the world. One of my favorite stories, it's a little bit of a messed up story, about one of the probable causes of chytrid spread. One, it was bullfrogs because people like eating frog legs, and they started shipping bullfrogs around the world to eat them. And it turns out worldwide trade of amphibians will cause disease spread like no one's business. And bullfrogs are slightly resistant to it. And so they could be carriers be shipped to a different country.
All around the world.
Yeah, and then if they escape or are let out or interact with native populations in any way, or just get into a waterway, that fungus can cause spores that end up in the water. The spores are motile and will go towards the chemicals that come off of a frog. And then they'll settle in that frog and spread and spread and spread. And so as soon as they spread, like settle, they create more spores that then go back out into water. And so it's extremely contagious. And so it's not just like frog-to-frog contact that will cause it. It's just being in the same waterway. Which is terrifying.
Horrifying.
But the funny story, if we have time for it, and it's only funny because it's so weird, is in the 1940s, there was something called the Hogbins test. That was a type of pregnancy test. And it was Xenopus laevis, which I think is the African clawed frog, was used as a pregnancy test by injecting the urine of a pregnant woman into the frog's back. And the presence of whatever hormone indicated pregnancy would cause this frog to express all of these eggs and like spheres. And it was a surprisingly accurate pregnancy test, despite being horrible and like not great for the frog. I think they were probably one-time use, if I had to guess. Like, I don't really know how it impacted. Not a lot of data on how it impacted the frogs. I don't think it's great. You can't usually inject pee into something and have it be fine. But because it was so effective as a pregnancy test, these African clawed frogs started being shipped worldwide because this is the most accurate pregnancy test, like 98% effective. And so they started shipping these animals all around the world. And those animals also are carriers of chytrid fungus. And so between the two things and between, you know, us moving and being a little bit more international and sort of international trade developing over the last century or so, it was bound to happen. But man, it is devastating.
Okay, so where are we at today with this, with the species and its population in the wild?
Mountain yellow-legged frogs? So many frogs in my life.
So many frogs.
So yeah, we think that there are less than 200 breeding-age adults in the wild. And I think that's sort of the best way to measure population status because you can measure juveniles, but they take a few years to reach maturity too. And so there's almost no point in knowing how many individuals there are total unless they're also contributing to creating more individuals. It's not too many. They've had chytrid, they've had the trout, and then most recently and sort of unfortunately just the cherry on top is all of the things that have come along with climate change in California. And so we had a pretty bad fire that happened in 2020 that essentially 90 to 95% of the remaining usable habitat for the mountain yellow-legged frogs got burned up.
Rough. Not doing great. Yeah.
And it's only funny to me because I'm so familiar with it that I'm like, man, they are taking their licks.
You have to laugh. Otherwise, you'll cry.
But after that fire, I guess if you could say the silver lining is that that sort of really catalyzed our involvement with the Mountain Yellow-Legged Frog Project because there were these tadpoles that they rescued from the fire that they were like, these guys need a home. And so we accelerated our timeline for being part of the project to accommodate these.
So this project already existed before this fire?
With other institutions, yes. And it was in our, I think, vague plan of the future eventually to be involved with. And, you know, obviously COVID happened and that was not ideal for any institution and sort of halted some of our development in this program. But when this fire happened, it really did sort of catapult us into we should really be involved sooner. And so we received, the first year that we were involved with Mountain Yellow-Legged Frogs, we got 150 captive bred tadpoles from LA Zoo, who's an amazing partner in this project, and they have adult mountain yellow-legged frogs that they will go through the process of breeding, and then they would have tadpoles, and to head start the tadpoles, like I said, could take up to 4 years. And so they have other institutions that are partners that receive the tadpoles and grow them up. Under the right conditions, they can metamorphose in about a year. So it's not that crazy of a commitment when you're providing them all the things that they need. But they gave us 150 of those, and then they gave us 125 fire tadpoles. That they're like, these guys almost died in a wildfire. You guys are going to take care of them now. And we're like, this is our first time ever doing this. And they're like, these are wild collected and extremely genetically valuable. But the challenge was accepted on our behalf. And we successfully raised so many of those animals. So we released 188 frogs last year. And to me, that is significant when you think about the 200 breeding age adults that are remaining in the wild. 188 is a huge impact.
They essentially doubled their population.
For like a day, probably. I'm hopeful that the recruitment rate is pretty good, but we don't know, right? Like,
yeah, you have to be realistic about it, right?
Yeah.
Do they currently have predators?
I mean, yeah, they've got predators. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's trout in some of the waterways, mm-hmm. although I'm pretty sure where they're releasing them doesn't. Mm-hmm. I'm actually not even allowed to know where,
yeah.
mm-hmm. which is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. And it's a mystery.
But it is in Southern California. Mm-hmm. Are we allowed to say that?
Yeah, okay. These guys mm-hmm. are native to the population that we have are from the San Gabriel Mountain Range. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, good luck finding them. There's so few of them. But they are in the San Gabriels. Mm-hmm. And this population is, at least. And so we have some more tadpoles that we're raising up and hopefully releasing pretty soon, maybe by the time this podcast Ooh, episode is even out. Maybe.
Yeah,
we
maybe.
Don't know.
What should you do if you see a mountain eel legged
frog?
Do
not touch it.
Please don't touch
Leave it alone.
Yeah.
Do not set fire to its habitat. Do not pass go.
Don't do, that.
Do not collect $200. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, genuinely.
Do not let the frogs give you $200.
Well,
that is their money.
If they can, they could afford
they
it.
They need it.
They live in large here at the aquarium, at least. But I think if you see those animals, and I think something to be, I don't know, a good steward of mm-hmm. any amphibian environment is to be extremely cognizant that chytrid is a super contagious disease, mm-hmm. and it's caused by fungus spores. And so if you are hiking through habitat of different amphibians and you regularly do that, mm-hmm. maybe just disinfect your shoes when you get home and, like, be more mindful of mm-hmm. how you might actually be spreading disease processes when you walk through these places. Because you can ask anyone I know. I will go out herping all the time. Mm-hmm. I love finding frogs. I love
herping is...
Herping is going to find herptiles, which mm-hmm. are reptiles and amphibians. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry about that. It's a very weird
it's
term
a funny name.
If you don't yes. explain yeah. it. But, you know, I specifically will go to try to find them in their natural mm-hmm. habitat. One, because I think they're cool. Mm-hmm. But two, it gives me such a better understanding of what I'm trying to replicate mm-hmm. if we have them here and, mm-hmm. like, how to meet their needs. And I think they're just really cute to find also. And so seeing what natural behaviors they might be displaying that I want to give them the opportunity to display and seeing where they live. And so seeing mountain yellow-legged frogs in their habitat gave me so much context to what I'm doing mm-hmm. and where they live. And, like, they live in a super high-flow, super cold water environment. And so we have spray bars that really increase the flow of our tanks so that they practice swimming better mm-hmm. and grow stronger legs. Mm-hmm. That might prepare them for
we're
release.
Training them.
Yeah, we're we just put little, like, sweatbands on all of them. The cutest thing
would.
Ever. So they are hopefully in recovery, but it's been a tough couple of mm-hmm. years. I mean, if you live in California, you might know we've had some really bad summers. We've had mm-hmm. wildfires. We've had droughts. And mm-hmm. all of those things impact the ability of these animals to survive. I mean, a tadpole in a little pond that dries up ain't gonna make it. And
yeah.
Especially if they're going to take 4 years
to
get out of the pond.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's that. And there's also habitat fragmentation. So if, you know, waterways dry up and there's only isolated little ponds, then that can actually create distinctly isolated populations mm-hmm. of these animals. And so they're not having the best time mm-hmm. out there, but we're hopeful that with all the work that we're doing, in addition to all the work that our partners are doing, and it's not just, you know, us through U.S. Geological Survey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, who else is involved?
San Diego Zoo is involved. Mm-hmm. They are doing a lot, actually, and they actually do some research as well to mm-hmm. understand better about what's going on with the animals and understand their anatomy and sort of what a mountain yellow-legged frog is. Mm-hmm. We're not doing any research here at the aquarium. But we are doing quite a bit of head starting. We have a pretty big capacity to mm-hmm. receive animals and raise them. And we're really hopeful that this year we might get to release about 90 to 100 more frogs, which
it's
is
really
super
exciting.
Cool. Mm-hmm. And we have three systems here. One has big frogs in it.
They are big.
My favorite one, and he will be memorialized in this podcast, is named Big Chicken. Because he looks like a chicken sitting on eggs. And he is like twice the size of the next biggest frog.
Big Chicken.
I love
we
big
love
chicken.
Big Chicken.
So he's
we'll
doing
make
great.
Him the cover photo for the podcast.
Can
He'll
you
be famous.
Next season's cover is just Big Chicken's
yelling
face.
Into a microphone.
I need to get a picture of him with his mouth open. But yeah, he's cool. We have just a bunch of animals that are waiting to have a nice home mm-hmm. to be released. And then USGS will let us know when it's time. And then they take our frogs and they put them out there.
So that room or that space is technically behind the scenes. And we mm-hmm. kind of chatted about that last week with Reed, who
yeah.
built the room and plumbed it alongside you. And you know,
no, he really did it.
Yeah.
Him and the life support team
yeah.
really did
That's
that.
Awesome. But will our guests on site ever be able to see a mountain yellow-legged frog displayed? Yes. Is that planned?
It's a good question. I think that it's something that we would love to incorporate. Stay tuned, maybe. I hope. Mm-hmm. Because, I don't know, they're cool. I don't think that most people would look at them and be like, wow. But it's the story, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's
absolutely.
And that's the same with most species, is like, mm-hmm. it's all about what happened to them and sort of like learning more about them as individuals. Mm-hmm. Something that is really cool that I've never smelled, that sounded weird, is apparently when they're threatened, they release a garlic smell. Uh-huh. I haven't threatened them enough, I guess, because they've never done it to me. But that's cool. You know, like, what is that? Why are you making a weird garlic smell? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Probably smells good.
So if you're walking in the San Gabriel Mountains and you smell garlic nearby,
it's probably garlic because there are so few frogs out there.
It's probably actually just someone camping. It's probably someone eating garlic.
No, but there are species that we should save because we did it to them, mm-hmm. you know? Everything mm-hmm. that's happening to them is human-caused. And they're animals that evolved to live in this, like, predatorless mm-hmm. cold waterway, and so they're okay living at 12,000 feet in the air. Mm-hmm. And so when you think about these creatures that have evolved over so many years to inhabit these extremely niche ecosystems, and then you think about us just being like, here's some fish, here's some disease, mm-hmm. and we've just kind of really messed with that cycle. Yeah. I think that that's a little bit disheartening. So it's been sort of the most inspiring thing to be a part of, and I didn't get to attend the release last year. Apparently, it was quite the trek into the mountains, mm-hmm. and they knew I would slow them down. And let's be honest, I would have. Because you have to carry a cooler full of frogs mm-hmm. up a mountain. Like, mm-hmm. I can't do that. I could barely walk up a mountain myself, not let alone cooler-less. With, like, 200 yeah. frogs on my back.
200 endangered frogs on
yeah,
my back.
I would tumble down the mountain. Mm-hmm. Then I'd be like, just go. Just they deserve to go. So, but they did send this picture that was like my phone background for months mm. because it was just one of our frogs on a rock in the wild. Mm. And I was like, that's the coolest thing I've maybe ever seen.
Yeah, that's awesome. Because that's so much work that went into just that one frog in order to be reintroduced.
Better make it.
What's his name?
I didn't name him.
You should name him.
Gabriel. San Gabriel. His name is Gabriel. So, I hope you're out there, Gabriel.
Hope you're out there.
It was funny.
Thriving.
For the couple weeks after we released them, I would think about them and be like, wonder what they're up to, you know? Like, I got to know you guys over the last year. Yeah. I mean, there was so many of them that mm-hmm. it was hard to know them each
individually. You walk into the mountains, they all jump on you.
They're like, mama! But at the same time, I would just think about them and be like, I wonder who's out there, like, yeah. who's making it? What mm-hmm. bugs are you eating?
Yeah.
And we're constantly looking for ways to improve our project, too, and set them up for better success. So this year we held on to a couple more of them until they were a little bigger. Mm-hmm. Maybe they do better when they're released bigger, which would make sense to me because then they're not 3 grams going out into like a river. But yeah. mm-hmm. they do okay. I mean,
big
it's
chicken
cool.
sized.
But yeah, we need That's to release ideal. Bid chickens. I call them bid chitten. Like he is some monster mm-hmm. size. And when they are first metamorphosed, they're 3 grams.
He's going to make it.
I hope so. He's kind of funny because I call him a den monster. I have a lot of names for him. But he likes to sit under this rock. Mm-hmm. And then if a cricket, like, crawls by, he'll, like, launch out and eat it and then go back into his little den. And I was like, if anyone's not going to get eaten by a bird, it's a big chicken. he knows what's up.
Get back in there. What are they eating here at the aquarium and what do they typically eat in the wild?
Yeah, I've done a little bit of research on what their natural diet is. And back in the 70s when there was like a million of them, mm-hmm. they used to catch them and they would open up their stomachs to see what the contents were. And there were beetles and there were like pond skaters and some like flies. Mm-hmm. Those things are not easy for us to source mm-hmm. as like a live food option. Mm-hmm. And so I've been doing my darndest to try to get them food that is close. Mm-hmm. And so they do eat crickets. That is a larger part of their diet because that is easy to source. Mm-hmm. The crickets are gut loaded and also dusted with vitamins. And for those of you who might own frogs, vitamins are important for frogs. Mm-hmm. They get calcium from those vitamins in addition to UV supplementation helps their bones grow. Mm-hmm. So supplement your frogs.
Supplement your frogs.
But they're also eating things like fruit flies, and I've recently introduced dubia roaches to mm-hmm. some of our bigger frogs that can handle that sort of tough exoskeleton.
Crunchy.
Yeah, and I wanted it to mimic beetles, you mm-hmm. know, like get used to eating mm-hmm. stuff that mm-hmm. you might see something like it. And I've recently started seeing this really cool behavior from some of our biggest frogs where they sit at the water surface with just their eyes out and their whole body's like poised to strike. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, there is nothing that mm-hmm. I am feeding you that would, like, skate across the surface. But mm-hmm. I could so see that being hunting behavior to catch, like, a pond skater, you know, mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. there it is, there it is. And then just launch themselves mm-hmm. at it.
Mm-hmm. So, their instincts are there.
Yeah, the instincts are there. The mm-hmm. food is not. So they're eating.
But hopefully will be. Is there any threat to their food in the wild right now? Or is it pretty abundant?
Not that I know of. I certainly, when I was hiking, bugs be out there. I guess mm-hmm. I don't know if it's their favorite bugs, mm-hmm. but bugs be out there. So I definitely got a lot of mosquito bites. It was out there. That's something that I didn't talk about is there was recently a study that showed amphibians are important because they control mosquito populations.
Yeah.
So if you care about amphibians.
If you care about getting bit. Would care about amphibians.
If you hate mosquitoes,
yeah.
love amphibians. That's
well, everything kind of, has a role in the ecosystem, yeah. right?
But except mosquitoes. Go away.
Do they really not have any purpose?
It depends. Just annoying. I'm sure they do, but I don't. I am very susceptible.
This is an anti-mosquito podcast.
We're going to have on like a mosquito expert next season and be like, what do we... Anyways, so... Yeah, that's kind of what we're doing here at the aquarium. Cool. The care is pretty intensive. Mm-hmm. I wish that it was a little bit easier to display, and I hope that someday it is.
It's so much work that you're doing just behind the scenes. But yeah, it's been a really fun story to hear about and see, and you know, getting the access to the room and seeing, you know, what you're doing back there has been really awesome too.
And seeing Bidchitten. He's so cute. He's so cute.
He's really cute.
Everyone who has come into the room like to do maintenance or like a couple of people have come in there, I've specifically shown them Big Chick. I was like, this is the biggest mountain yellow-legged frog
you will ever see.
I have ever mm-hmm. seen as someone who has seen way more than most
well,
people.
We have more big chickens. What will be the next name? Bigger chicken?
Goose. Large goose.
Eagle.
As they continue to grow, just continue. This is enormous ostrich. He's a 600-pound mountain yellow-legged frog, 330 feet long. That's my dream. So he's the dream. No, I really hope that their populations start to recover, and we're hoping that sort of as animals adapt to chytrid and that mm-hmm. becomes more of a normal part of their life, that they also start to find ways to adapt and evolve alongside it. There's some evidence to suggest that maybe frogs sun themselves so heavily because chytrid doesn't do well mm-hmm. with heat. And mm-hmm. so they're actually just cooking the fungus
baking
off their
out.
Back to like, mm-hmm. get it off me. Mm-hmm. And then interestingly, tadpoles are really not impacted by chytrid mm. as much because their skin isn't keratinized. There's mm-hmm. no keratin in their epidermis. Mm-hmm. There is keratin in their little raspy mouth parts though. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes if a tadpole has chytrid, mm-hmm. you could tell by abnormalities of the oral disc. Mm. So their little mouth parts won't mm-hmm. be developed properly or they'll be sort of eaten away by that. So chytrid is an ever-present risk. And mm-hmm. so part of the reason why we have such strict biosecurity around our mountain yellow-legged frogs is to prevent introduction because we've tested them before we release them just to be, you know, doing our due diligence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
just
you don't
want to
release.
Yeah, that would be so
sad. Yeah, that would be detrimental. Mm-hmm.
So we have, like, a foot bath, a boot change that goes into it. We mm-hmm. have very strict cross-contamination protocols that you can't work with mountain frogs if you've worked with the amphibian gallery. Mm-hmm. And not to say that anyone in the gallery has chytrid. Like, that's not the case. Mm-hmm. But you never know what diseases you might be introducing when mm-hmm. you work with similar species in the same day. So we are pretty strict about our mountain yellow-legged frogs. That's half the reason they're behind the scenes, too, mm-hmm. is to create this little bubble. Also, I will be lying to you if I told you that that wasn't my favorite room because it's air-conditioned.
I know. It is really nice on a hot day.
It's like 93 degrees today, mm-hmm. and it is 64 degrees in there, and the water is 50. And so if I'm doing water changes, I'll come out shivering, and everyone's like, what is wrong with you? It is 90 degrees out
like, you don't know what I'm just doing.
You don't know what I've been through.
I was in the tundra.
I have been in the alpine mountain lakes of the mountain frogs. So it's been really great. And
that's awesome.
Yeah. Shout out to Frankie, wherever you are listening
yeah,
to this.
Wherever you are.
Frankie,
we know you're listening.
Frankie and I both had sort of the experience of like, after that first round was released, it almost felt mm-hmm. like our kids went to
yeah,
college.
Yeah,
you know,
empty
like,
nest.
There they go. They're doing so well. And to see that picture.
Here's 150 more.
Yeah. Here's all your babies back. So that was... That I mean, it's a really
That's
salient
awesome.
Point, right? It's an ever-going mm-hmm. project because as soon mm-hmm. as we release, we're trying to take on more and
yeah.
continue to grow up more. And we've expanded our capacity recently. We have mm-hmm. a third system running, whereas we had two for the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
So we're pretty happy with it.
That's
and
awesome.
If you ever want to be air-conditioned, too bad, because I'm the only one allowed in that room.
You can't.
No, it's really nice.
That's
and
awesome.
I'm very lucky.
Well, it's so great hearing you talk about it, and I know your dedication to it, and I'm lucky to see
I
that up close.
Hate them. I actually don't like frogs at all.
No, it's been really cool, and I learned so much through this episode, and you know, being close with you and hearing about them one-on-one has been awesome.
all the time.
All the time.
Constantly. Frogs. At every point.
Yeah, hey, can I tell you about these frogs?
Can I tell you about what my frogs are doing today? Right. They were being so cute today. Chicken. So many pictures and videos.
Wow, he's 1 gram bigger. Wow.
Hey.
Awesome. No, I'm
proud of
him.
Leave Big Chicken alone.
I'm so proud
you
of him.
You can roast the other ones, but Big Chicken is...
Unroastable.
He's our star quarterback.
Roast another chicken.
Yeah. Roast another chicken.
That's awesome. Well, are there any conservation efforts that you hope to be a part of coming up in your career here at the Aquarium of the Pacific?
I think we do a lot. And I think with sea otter surrogacy and mountain yellow-legged frogs, I certainly get to be a part of a lot of our front-facing conservation work. As I always introduce myself in the beginning of the episode, my position now is conservation coordinator for mammals and birds. And that
and
position
frogs.
And frogs. We just I think our department is called mammals and birds, but frogs fall under
amphibians.
Us. But with my new position, I get to help identify sort of what projects our aquarium can like work towards. And one of the things that I've been working on is having people volunteer for habitat restoration and other conservancies that are local. And also get some hands-on experience doing other things. I get to help coordinate some of our training for the Oiled Wildlife Care Network. So some of our staff are actually trained to respond to an oil spill and save whatever wildlife might be impacted by that oil spill. And so I get to help coordinate some of those efforts now with Frankie also, which
that's
is very
awesome.
Fun. And so
Frankie's our invisible guest.
Yeah, Frankie's
we really
here.
Need to have her on.
We will.
That would be awesome.
But I do think that it's been cool to see like these other people come through my life and grow up in their careers and move on to other things, but have them still be connections. Frankie is coordinating a lot of the volunteer response for the Oiled Wildlife Care Network. And so I still get to talk to my friends.
Yeah, they're all connected.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh, this is what networking means. This is being a professional and like knowing people. But also, it's just so amazing to see people grow into these roles and become this like overarching network of like, we're going to save the world.
That's amazing. I think it's great that the aquarium is getting involved into habitats before there's a huge problem.
Yeah,
maybe there's kind of symptoms of a problem starting, but you know, things aren't necessarily going extinct, but we're also hopping on to traumatic issues.
Yeah.
Traumatic's not the right word.
We
but
respond to a lot of different
like
disasters.
Oil spill. Yeah, disaster is the right word.
Traumatic
disaster.
And we had some staff respond to the Huntington Beach oil spill that happened in 2021. To have a network of responders that can respond to anything, you know, at a given moment is really cool. And it's not easy to respond to the wildlife portion of an oil spill because you are having to pick up an angry wild bird or, you know,
something never been handled before. Yeah.
And so the Oiled Wildlife Care Network is this amazing organization that kind of links together different people at different institutions, then creates this network that like, hey, there's an oil spill in San Diego. We have local San Diego responders who will then go out and do it. Or if there's one in Huntington Beach, we got mobilized for that. And so we really get to be a part of a lot of different things. And I like having people trained and at the ready to go rather than trying to retroactively train people when something happens.
Exactly. We're ready. Because unfortunately,
stuff happens.
Yeah.
But we're here to fix it when it happens, I guess.
Yeah. And to maybe prevent it from happening in the first place. But that's going to take a little extra work.
Yeah. For now, we will raise the frogs and release them.
Well, thank you so much, Erin, for being my guest today on my podcast.
Oh, okay.
Our podcast, Aquarium of the Pacific. It was really great to hear about your passion for these
little frogs.
And one big frog.
Big chicken. I think that I should send you guys a picture of Big Chicken.
I think you should. I think you should. He should be the cover photo.
He looks like he's sitting on eggs. Like a chicken. He's cute. I hope we get to release them pretty soon. That would be awesome. And I did want to say thank you to all the partners in the Mountain Yellow-Legged Frog Program because it takes a village to raise
truly
a clutch of tadpoles. And I know that sounds really silly, but like, you know, even our life support department built that entire room. They were there today doing maintenance to make sure that the chillers keep the water cold enough. And we have facilities who helps maintain, like, the way the AC system works in there to keep it cool enough in there. And we have all the husbandry staff who are involved with it. And then we have these partner organizations. And then we have this, like, overarching management system. And it's just so many people working together to save a species. It's really neat to see.
That's awesome.
Superheroes.
Superheroes.
But frogs.
But
frogs. Yeah.
I just picture little frogs with little capes.
Big
super
chicken.
Frog.
Put a cape on Big Chicken. Oh, my goodness.
Super Big Chicken.
That's just when he gets bigger. We're just going to call him Super
He'll
Big
get
Chicken.
There. He'll get there. Cool. Well, thank you so much, Erin. That was awesome. And thank you so much to everybody who listened to our season. We're podcasters. Whoa. We made a whole season.
And thank you to everyone who participated in this season, yeah. too. I learned about turtles and mm-hmm. sharks and mm-hmm. jellies and mm-hmm. sea stars and facilities and life support mm-hmm. and basically everything that we do here. So I think we're done. The podcast is over.
No, we won't be done. We are not done. We'll be back in a couple months with season two. So let us know what you thought about this season. Let us know what you liked.
Yeah.
I'm sensitive, so don't tell us anything you didn't.
Madeline is the one that receives the comments. She mm-hmm. shows me sometimes one of them just said, great information, which I really loved mm-hmm. seeing that feedback. Mm-hmm. But also thank you, Scott, who's been quietly sitting Scott. Here all season.
Mm-hmm. Just listening to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my pleasure.
Our number one listener, Scott Shaw.
He has listened to every really episode. But yeah, it's been great. And thank you guys so much for listening. Please write into any avenue that mm-hmm. you can contact the Aquarium. Madeline manages a lot of our social media. And so if you... Instagram message
mm-hmm.
or pretty Facebook much if message.
You do anything on social media and you tag us in it, I'm going to see it. So I'd love to hear your feedback. What you want to hear on next season, let us know. Cool. Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you, Madeline.
Thank you, Podcific listeners.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Scott. We'll see you next season.
Bye.
Bye. Aquarium of the Podcific is brought to you by Aquarium of the Pacific, a 501c3 nonprofit organization. In 2023, the Aquarium celebrates 25 years of connecting millions of people worldwide to the beauty and wonder of our ocean planet. Head to aquariumofpacific.org to learn more about our 25th anniversary celebration. Keep up with the Aquarium on social media at Aquarium Pacific on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn.
This podcast is produced by Aaron Lundy, Madeline Walden, and Scott Shaw. Our music is by Andrew Reitzma, and our podcast art is by Brandy Kenny. Special thanks to Cecile Fisher, Anitza Valles, and our audiovisual and education departments, and to all of our amazing podcast guests for taking time out of their day to talk about the important work that they do. Podcific wouldn't be possible without the support of the Aquarium's donors, members, guests, and supporters. Thanks for listening.